Hello everyone and welcome to the Pearson Future Tech for Education series on the EdTech podcast. My name is Sophie Bailey and each week I'll be exploring the challenges and opportunities of future tech for education with contributors from across industry, research and academia.
A new study estimates that 47% of U.S. jobs could be automated.
We are living in the age of machine learning and artificial intelligence.
It's no longer a matter of if, but rather when.
One new job will be created for every 15 that are lost.
My days are numbered too, so don't worry about it.
Automation and robotics is already changing the workplace.
Machines are being trained to do jobs you think that only humans can do.
Cognitive computing.
Machines are coming for you and they're coming for you fast. Our days are actually numbered.
People are anxious.
The future is now.
Nice knowing you.
And relax.
Take a moment or two to get comfortable before the meditation begins.
Melvin Kranzberg, a past professor of the history of technology at Georgia Tech, famously said, "Technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral." In this episode, we look at how to maintain responsible and calm digital citizenship at a time of screaming headlines, whilst also looking at the necessary ethical and philosophical questions which come with advanced technology. We also review what the future of work might look like, following research conducted by Pearson and Nestor on the future of skills and employment in 2030. Here's Dennis Hurley, Director of Future Technologies at Pearson, to kick us off.
Hi, Sophie.
First of all, why should we remain calm around tech?
Well, it's hard to remain calm since, again, we fear what we don't understand. But humans, once we figure out how to survive, we thrive. We're an adaptive species. There aren't many parts of the globe where we can't live, even in some of the harshest conditions. Major advances in technology disrupt our personal and work lives, and they also reshape our society, the very ways that humans interact with each other and our environments themselves, which is why my comparison to extreme environmental conditions. But we're not used to making drastic adjustments within one lifetime. So, for example, in the United States, about 200 years ago, over 70% of people worked in agriculture. As the Industrial Revolution continued, more people began to work in factories, as we know, and this required new skills and new ways of living. We needed unions to fight against abuses. Cities had to adjust to a mass influx of new residents. The Luddites tried to resist this change. They were actually a group of people who physically destroyed machines. But progress is inevitable, and in time, these changes led to an overall net good to society. Advances in technology, and these are all intertwined, technology used for advances in work, in medicine, led to a decrease in infant mortality, a decrease in extreme poverty, and an increase in literacy, among other things. These improvements came with a price, to be sure, oftentimes environmental. With the fourth industrial revolution, which we're beginning right now, it's a convergence of physical, even biological, with the digital, even virtual. Thankfully, evidence suggests that we are finally incorporating more green technology. Neo-Luddites lament the past and resist these changes, but I don't think they're going to be any more successful than their predecessors.
Based on some of this, which jobs are you seeing that will survive this wave of change?
Interestingly, the skills that are going to be most important in addition to digital fluency are human skills. For most of humans' existence, we could expect our lives to be very much like the lives of our grandparents, and the same for even the lives of our grandchildren. But our day-to-day lives were full of unexpected challenges and problems to be solved. As we began to work more closely with technology over the past few hundred years, this has required us to perform more rote tasks. But now, finally, the machines are able to do many of these rote tasks themselves. In many ways, the level of technological advancement that we are reaching is finally freeing us up to be even more human. I don't like the term soft skills because it seems disparaging, and these skills are not new to the 21st century. I like the term human skills because it's about our flexibility, our problem solving, interpersonal skills, creativity, the skills that really set us apart from other animals. And we do need to know how to use these skills in conjunction with digital skills or digital fluency. This is in order to be chirons, the best combination of what humans and machines can do, respectively.
So Churchill said, "We shape our buildings, thereafter they shape us." And McLuhan paraphrased him with, "We shape our tools, thereafter they shape us." In our description of this episode, you know, we were talking about how technology is a part of almost every aspect of our lives. So buildings can be 3D printed, cars can drive themselves, and algorithms can direct our education. So from this perspective of tools shaping us, what should the people listening in look out for in the sense of them still remaining a kind of active participant in how teaching and learning is put together?
A natural progression on the thoughts by Churchill and McLuhan is that we shape our algorithms and thereafter our algorithms shape us. So I think that's why we need to be mindful of how we're programming these algorithms, how we're programming our systems, and also always being aware of how they are impacting us, how they are affecting us. I see a lot of people who are resistant to too much predictability. It's almost like it removes a bit of serendipity from our day-to-day lives, which people do value.
Governments around the world are furiously trying to focus on STEM and certainly science and maths very intensively. And then at the same time, we're being told that, you know, the sort of human collaborative skills, global competency skills are at a premium as well. So how do you sort of see that STEM and then more human skills working together in this kind of education landscape? So where perhaps some people fear that humanities is getting sidelined?
I think in our rush to promote STEM in schools, we're missing the spirit of what STEM was really meant to be. STEM is not used or should not be used as a way just to teach a coding language. STEM or STEAM or the maker movement, whatever you want to call it, is about teaching creativity and problem solving, even working with your hands. It's, again, working in conjunction with technology. It's not about just learning a language.
Interesting. So at a time of increased focus on STEM, creativity skills come at a premium. Confusing. But whilst job creation happens alongside job losses, is there a chance that technologies such as AI will increase inequity in education and employment? Here's Paolo Falco, economist at the OECD, on the potential risk of future work scenarios in the near term.
Hello, thank you for having me.
What worries you about future employment scenarios you see coming online?
Well, I'll start answering this question by telling you what I am not too worried about. As I'm sure you're aware, many commentators, many experts have been increasingly worried that automation will lead to what is often referred to as technological unemployment. To put it simply, robots, machines, will take our jobs and there will be little to do for humans. This is a worry that's emerged many times in history, if anything, since the first Industrial Revolution. And we have little evidence by looking at history to believe that indeed what technology does is displacing humans to the point of them remaining unemployed. Of course, some jobs will disappear, but history shows that if anything, employment rates, despite the great increase in technology, the great advancements of technology, have been increasing over the last centuries. So, in sum, I'm not too worried that there will not be much to do for humans, that humans will be left idle and unemployed. There is, however, a concern in what might seem like a relatively rosy picture I'm painting here, which is that obviously many jobs will disappear while others will be created, and what becomes crucial is to enable the people that have to move, that have to transition from one side of the market to another, to do so effectively with little disruption and with as little harm as possible to their welfare. So what I am concerned about is the fact that our societies, our economies, may be ill-prepared to facilitate this type of transitions. What am I thinking about? Well, I'm thinking about, in particular, social protection, so the systems that help workers cope with shocks in the labor market, and the shock par excellence, the shock that everybody is worried about, is losing a job. And then I'm thinking about systems of skilling, education, and in particular adult learning, which is what should enable workers who need to move from one side of the market to another to do so effectively. Let's think about the last of these two concerns. What we know pretty much wherever we look in the OECD is that many people in the labor market are very ill prepared for the new technologies that are coming in. Many jobs are changing. Many jobs are in increasing need of being able to master digital technologies, for example. And we find that about 50% of adults in OECD countries are barely able to use technologies of this kind for any simple tasks that their jobs might require. Second, and possibly even more worrying, what we find is that our education systems, and in particular our systems of adult learning, are particularly bad at filling these gaps. One source of data generally describes this idea very well, and it's the fact that pretty much wherever you look in the OECD, once again, even in countries that are relatively good at adult learning, at on-the-job training, like Scandinavian countries, for example, the people who need training the most get the least of it. Firms typically, we're talking about on-the-job training here, tend to invest in workers who are already among the ones that are most skilled when it comes to giving them new competencies. What does this do? It increases disparities. It increases divergence. It increases inequality. And just to sum up, what I would say is possibly the main worry looking at the future is not so much that it will be a jobless future without anything to do because the robots will take care of all the jobs, but it could be a future of increasing inequality between those who have been able to benefit from the incredible opportunities that new technologies, that globalization have brought into our world, and other people who have been left behind, those who have not been able to benefit from technology, those who have not been able to reskill, those who have not been able to receive enough support in order to make the transition. The second policy issue that is somewhat worrying looking at the future is that our systems of social welfare, of social protection, may be ill-prepared for it. And in particular, there is one issue that immediately comes to mind as representative of this problem, which is that because the system is still based on the idea that benefits should be linked to jobs as opposed to employment, and therefore, when it comes to more fragmented, more flexible new forms of work, like self-employment, which don't belong to the classic stereotype of the job for life that a worker would get immediately after education and keep until retirement. When it comes to these forms of work, social protection is very ill prepared and unable to give workers the same level of protection as they would have in a salaried job. Why is this important? Well, if anything, because once again, it speaks of our systems of social protection and our policy frameworks more generally being ill-prepared for the new forms of work, for the future work, for what's coming. And because it brings me back to the point that I made earlier about disparities, because once again, we're talking about the risk that certain categories of workers, those who do not belong to the classic stereotype or somewhat stereotypical idea of salaried work for life, but instead have more fragmented careers be it because they want it, be it because they cannot do otherwise, may be very, very differently treated by the system compared to those who instead do belong, do conform to that category. And this is, again, an issue of inequalities rising. It's an issue of disparities becoming more accentuated. And eventually, it's the risk of the future work being a lot more of an unequal place than what we would like it to be.
Alas, it's not all bad. Many business and community leaders, education players, and ministries of education are already thinking about how best to equip for this new world of agile, self-directed learning. With aging populations in the West happening simultaneously to baby booms in China and Indonesia, creating unique education, employment, and training opportunities for each region will be essential. But what will be the impact on us as learners and employees? Will we all be worn out by the demands of continually upskilling and competing with non-human intelligence? Or will our potential release from the 9-to-5 offer new hope for leisure time, learning for learning's sake, and caring for our loved ones? Heather McGowan, co-founder, Work to Learn.
Thank you for having me.
How can we best refigure as teachers and learners to accommodate for the future of work?
I think the first thing we need to do is shift our expectations. We have massified the higher ed institutions in the U.S. from 1950 to 1990. We doubled the number of institutions. And that was for three reasons. We had civil rights, women's rights, and the GI Bill. So suddenly we had a larger market supply that was ready to go for higher ed. And at the same time, we had increasing market demand from the information revolution. So in that process, we ended up making many institutions of higher learning, and in fact, the process of learning about becoming something. You are asked when you're a kid what you want to be when you grow up. You're asked when you're in college, and often before you start college or university, what your major is. And then at a cocktail party, we ask each other what we do. And that what is an application of skills and knowledge at a moment in time. And that worked fine when that moment in time was relatively stable, and you did that thing for, you know, 20 or 30 years or whatever the arc of your career is. Now the velocity of change is such, and the career arc is so much longer, that we can't answer with that what. We can't keep that in our mind as terms of how we define ourselves. So as educators, we have to stop and say, how do we approach this? How do we tap into what somebody's interested in, not based upon what they're going to become? Because in many instances, we don't know what that is. And in other instances, it's certainly going to change. And how do we tap into somebody's passion? What are they innately interested in? Because if we've got this concept of lifelong learning, something's got to fuel that, and it's got to be an internal drive. So I'd say the first thing we need to do is shift expectations from mindsets to skill sets. So where we used to chase skill sets so that you could be something, I think we need to focus on developing mindsets that are based on the expectation that you're just going to continuously learn and adapt in pursuit of your passion and your purpose.
So that's really interesting. And perhaps in the old model, you know, you go through your conveyor belt of education and then you arrive at the end and you get your nice job. And then at the end of that, you get your pension. In this kind of changing world that we are currently experiencing and predicting will develop even further in the future, what will industry's role be as the educator?
That's a great question, because I think that everybody's thought of education happens over here in this block, and work happens in this block, and retirement happens in this block, and they were three blocks we went through in sequence. And now those blocks are stacked on the other axis. I'm drawing pictures in the air because I generally use visual to explain these things. And we're going to be moving in and out of those blocks. So industry's role in it, whether you're in the education industry, as that's the purpose of your organization, or you're in any other industry, everybody's got to be in the learning business.
And from a learner's perspective as well, we like to think that a lot of the hard work that goes in, and you know, if it means and entails passing exams to get on to the next stage of our education, it is the fact that we add value in some way, whether that's academically in research or if we're in a particular specialism within work and so on. You know, in this new paradigm of sharing intelligence with others, so for example, that could be a cognitive assistant or AI. What's the kind of psychology around that as learners? So, you know, if we're potentially sidelined or have to accommodate and get used to the idea of working alongside other forms of intelligence that can be useful as well.
I think that's the shift we need to make. A lot of shifts here, but I think that's the shift we need to make from thinking of that non-biological intelligence as a tool, if you think about it in terms of tools, we used to learn to use a tool. So you learn to use hand tools in the old days, and then you learn to use technology later on. And that you couldn't use the technology unless you learned it first, learned how to use it first. And now I think we're learning from and with technology. And you look at things like generative design that co-creates physical structures with the designer, or with the engineer. We need to shift towards that, looking at that non-biological intelligence, whatever form it's in, not as competition, not as something we have to learn to use, but how we have to learn to collaborate and learn from.
You know, some people talk about universal basic income and us having more leisure time, which makes me laugh when we have jobs that we don't enjoy. But then when we think about having more leisure time, we throw our arms up. And I think there's a comparative thing there with sort of teachers being overrun and then also not wanting to give away too much because it's a very integral role as well. But when we think about things like universal basic income and so on, what would we do with all of our spare time? And what does this mean for learning as well? You know, will it become a thing where we learn new skills for their own sake? Or will we feel a little bit lost because we don't have that sort of 9-to-5 structure which we've existed within for so long?
Well, I think I can answer that in a whole bunch of different directions. I think that's a heated topic. But universal basic income is an idea, I think, that's in some regards well thought out, in some regards poorly thought out. It's well thought out by the folks who look at, if you remove the layer of stress, constant stress, in people's lives who are facing poverty where they can't be productive because there are so many hurdles constantly in their way. If you look at universal basic income as a way of removing those barriers so they can be more productive and more happy, and I don't mean productive in terms of economically productive, I mean human beings need purpose. We need to be productive. We weren't meant to sit idly. So it's whether you learn for leisure sake, or you take care of loved ones, or you pursue passions that are not going to offer an economic return. That's what I mean by that. But those who are out there who say, you know, technology is going to take over everything, and so there's a section of the population that needs to just be paid to do nothing, I think that's a little bit of lazy thinking. I think we do not live yet in a utopian society, and there are plenty of things that need to be done, particularly uniquely human things, as we look at aging populations that we need to take care of, an environment that's, you know, trashed for the most part that we need to take care of. There are a lot of things out there that need to be done, and I think we need to add tie productivity and purpose to economic activity.
As I mentioned before, you know, there's this idea of different education at different stages of your life, whereas in reality, probably the largest section of learners in the kind of foreseeable future will be the over 60s, whereas our education systems generally are catered around, you know, the K-12 and then higher education, etc. So we've got a real mix of different demographics and their own educational needs. I just wondered how you see both our education, teaching and learning structures, and also the work structures to cater for this kind of diversity of different learners and employees out there as well.
Sure. I mean, as you mentioned, our education system is based upon a series of intensive activities in about the first third of your life or the first quarter of your life, now that we've got more longevity. And then this idea that you will then, you know, siphon off that dose of education for the rest of your career. I think it's been pretty proven that that is no longer sufficient. But how do we replace that? I think one of the first things we need to do is realize, if you look at all the sort of new economy companies, the born digital companies, whether it's Amazon, Facebook, Google, etc., the median age in those companies are about 30 or sub 30. But the median age in our working population is 40 plus. And if we're looking at a time where 65 is going to become 75 in terms of retirement age, you've got a huge band of the workforce out there that came out of that factory production model. They went to higher ed declaring what they were going to be. They stepped on the escalator as that IMX. And many of them, if they've been in an industry that hasn't been disrupted yet, have defined themselves by that and rewarded greatly, in many cases, for being that X. And when those individuals become unbundled from the workforce through some form of digital disruption, our first reaction is, well, we need to retool those guys with new skills. And I think the reality is we can't lunge at skill sets. We have to acknowledge the loss they're going through of identity and help them adapt, help them make sense of what's happened to them, help them redefine themselves, help them find their passion and purpose that led them to that becoming that X way back when. And then once you've established that sort of what I call an agile learning mindset, then you can layer on different skills, but with the expectation that they're going to have to reskill repeatedly. because they've had one skill that they learned 20 years ago that took them this long. Their next skill may only take them 5 years, and they may have another 10 years to work. So we need to work on helping people redefine themselves and developing an agile learning mindset before we start layering in skill sets. And in order to do that, we need entirely new systems of learning. It can't be based on the first 30 year life. It's got to be a system of learning you dip in and out of every 3 to 5 years.
I think that's absolutely fascinating, because anyone who's been employed and sort of gone through the, you know, those tests that you do, whether you work out whether you're a yellow or a red, or, you know, if you're a bold person or more creative, and how they like to kind of dissect you into different types, I would imagine there are going to be personalities out there that will do very well on this new, in this new world of employment, whether they are educators or learners or employees. And then there will be some that, you know, they liked the kind of structure and the consistency of the of what we might call the old world. So are you sort of seeing that in terms of how people may or may not cope with this change as well?
Absolutely. And I think we're seeing that around the globe with populist movements that are, you know, just delve into politics. That's a that's not a reaction to anything other than globalization and technology. That's a segment of the population for whom the world wasn't supposed to change. It did change. They don't feel like they have a place. And so they're trying to return to a former state, which was pre-technology and pre-diversity of individuals and populations. So absolutely. And the response has been incredible, particularly in the U.S. So, I mean, we're just sort of shocked in some cases in terms of the desire for days long gone by. I mean, those jobs aren't coming back. They weren't lost to a trade deal. They were lost to technology. So absolutely, I'm seeing that. And we're seeing it on a global scale. You see it in the UK. You're seeing it all over the world.
So there you have it. As humans, we are still needed, and job creation continues, as does job erosion. But substantive changes are needed within our learning and employment systems if we are to lessen the impact of a digital divide and keep humans engaged and productive, whether socially or economically. This isn't just a challenge for our young people coming up through the traditional education system, but also to the many over 60s who still have so much to offer. As Mustafa Suleiman, the co-founder of DeepMind, said at a recent RSA event, a fair world will not arrive by accident. We need to design our technology systems so that they support our higher selves. This means it's just as important to instill the philosophical and ethical critical thinking skills in all of us, as well as the technical skills of implementation. In this way, we may be able to keep on top of where the technological bias may reside in our digital societies and how to question them. Till next time, that's the end of our third episode in this series. Next week, we look at how future tech is fast-changing language learning through virtual and augmented reality, neural machine translation, and biosyncing. Want to leave feedback? Tweet us at podcastedtech and at Dennis Hurley, or check out the Pearson podcast page at tinyurl.com/PearsonFutureTech, where you can also find more content, reports and insight on everything from parental engagement, open APIs for edtech developers, or what skills you might need for the most prevalent jobs in 2030. I'll drop that link, show notes and more at www.theedtechpodcast.com.
Throughout human history, one of our big successes has been the development of more and more technology.
So I'd say the first thing we need to do is shift expectations from mindsets to skill sets.
We are so trained to fear AI.
The AI-based design company seems to be at a distinct disadvantage.
It's so cool that we can get students to engage with computations and so on. What should the humans do versus what should you let technology do?
And that what is an application of skills and knowledge at a moment in time.
They have enormous computing resources and the latest AI technology on their side.
So as educators, we have to stop and say, how do we approach this?
Artificial intelligence is a program or an algorithm that can function like a human.
Their human rivals have all had years of industrial experience designing cars, bikes, and engines.
Everybody's got to be in the learning business.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more on AI, languages, gaming, assessment without tests, and personalized learning, make sure you subscribe to the EdTech Podcast on iTunes, where you can also leave a review. Thanks for listening in, and we look forward to hearing your own future tech for education related stories.